This is Building Bridges, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Later on, the New York Police Department's Intelligence Division's surveillance of Muslims and its extension to community, labor, immigration, and police accountability activists.
But first, recently, the New York Taxi Workers Alliance rallied at the SLS Jet Garage in Long Island City, Queens, who has a practice of not allowing drivers to pay their lease fee in advance for their shifts, and then charging those same drivers as much as $25 a day for not paying in advance, adding up to more than $9,000 a year.
The Taxi Workers Alliance has just become a new chartered union with the AFL-CIO, which will be celebrated at an upcoming reception with AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka in New York City. The new National Taxi Workers Alliance, the 57th chartered union of the AFL-CIO, is a watershed moment in U.S. labor history. I mean, this is the first new chapter for non-traditional workers in over 60 years and the first for independent contractors. Beta V. Desai, Executive Director of the New York Taxi Workers Alliance, congratulations and thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Mimi and Ken.
And Beta V., let's start local and then talk national, and we'll talk about some of the events that will be happening around the celebration of this new development in your union. But let's talk about what you've been doing in the city the last couple of weeks, which is that demonstration at the SLS garage. Tell us what happened at the last demonstration.
SLS, it's a really infamous garage in the taxi industry. I mean, we've come to know it as the worst in the bunch, and believe me, that is not an easy title to earn. When drivers go to pay the dispatcher, they won't collect the money up front. And then a few hours later, in the middle of the shift, they'll notify you that you've been charged a late payment fee. It's just such a scam. Essentially, the Taxi Limousine Commission, the city's agency, caps the total amount of the lease that the garages can charge drivers, either on a daily shift basis or a weekly shift basis. First of all, none of the garages will charge the driver at the weekly rate, which is about $200 less than the when you add up each of the daily rates throughout the week. And so they've been doing that since 2004. On top of that now, what SLS Jet has been doing since last year is adding on this additional late payment fee. Started out at $10, then $15, now it's $25 per shift. I mean, this is an incredibly grueling job. You know, drivers labor 60 to 70 hour weeks. There's no guaranteed income. There's no health care. And that extra that they're paying, which could amount to $9,000 at the end of the year, is a very real difference between minimum wage or living wage and poverty wages.
Beta B, how widespread is this phenomena that you described at SLS Jet Garage?
Well, overcharges in general are just systematic across the board, whether it be garages charging the drivers the daily rate instead of the discounted weekly rate, or it's tacking on these additional fees. We just heard today about a garage that's now, you know, newly started the same practice as SLS Jet. And then, you know, about 40% of the drivers lease from a traditional garage. But a larger segment of drivers actually lease from what's called a broker. They own the vehicle and they lease the medallion. And in that scenario, the brokers are infamous for creating these extra charges on top of the medallion lease cap and calling it a vehicle expense. In addition to that, they'll charge you very high, you know, usury financing rates when you buy the vehicle from them. So nowadays, we know drivers are paying close to $60,000 on vehicles that are valued at $30,000. I mean, that's the sale price, but the driver is paying $60,000. You know, on top of overcharges on the lease, which amount to an additional $10,000 extra per year. You know, there's so much crime and corruption in this industry, you know, white-collar crime, right, which all gets overlooked because, you know, the victims are, it's the workers. It's primarily workforce, 94% immigrants, mostly people of color, workers who are non-traditional, and so we're not under the labor laws. We don't have any of those basic labor protections. Much of this is contracted, so there's a lot of complication to it, but we know that ultimately organizing and direct action is the only way to bring about change.
Well, this is all on top, as I see it at least, a system which is totally ridiculous to begin with in that the workers have to pay to go to work.
Absolutely. You know, it's such an upside-down world. You know, it's a transportation industry, but the vehicle, which is the capital you need in order to go to work every day, has a secondary value. It's held hostage to the value of the actual medallion. We're a public service industry, but the passenger is only the customer of the driver. The drivers are seen as the customers of the big bosses in the industry. So the garages, the brokers, the lenders, the banks, you know, the technology vendors, they are all far and removed from their relationship with the riding public, even though it's a public service industry.
By the way, how many medallions can an owner have? Is it just one or can they have multiple? I'm just trying to get a handle on who really controls this industry.
No, they can have multiple. So there's a corporate medallion. You buy that two at a time. It's called a mini fleet. Well, mini fleet is now valued at $2 million. So one corporate medallion is $1 million. Mind you, in the early 1970s, it was less than $30,000. And we've really seen that since leasing was brought in, you know, before it was under commission, but since the early 80s, we've operated under a leasing system. And you can really trace the upgrade of the value of the medallion to the development of leasing. You know, you place that against what's happened to driver incomes, which have gradually come down. And really over the past 4 years, the downward slide has really accelerated, not only with the increase in the price of fuel. Under leasing, you pay anywhere from $105 up to $132, plus an extra $5 tax, because since we're seen as independent contractors, New York State charges taxi drivers a consumer tax to lease out the taxi every single day of close to $5. On top of that, you're paying for the fuel and other vehicle expenses, bribe to the dispatcher to get the car on time or to at least get you a good car. All of those things really add up. So increasingly, the costs of the business are borne by the workers. On top of that, the owners also don't have to have any personnel expenses like Social Security contribution, or certainly not, you know, health care or wages.
But this is a system that's really only come about. It didn't used to be like this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, was it Koch that instituted this new system when the union began to be strong in the taxi industry? And I mean, it's not a natural state of affairs that this is the only way of running things.
Absolutely. But, you know, leasing is really become, you know, it's a gold mine for the bosses. And, you know, we've really seen in the past 30 years, right, a global trend where I think the taxi industry has very much been in the forefront of sweating the workers, you know, through this system. But we've seen it operated increasingly in even, you know, other parts of the economy. I mean, the trucking industry, for example, you know, where you have a growth in leasing now, or just an independent contractorship. So the traditional relationship between the employer and the employee no longer exists, and therefore the workers are stripped of basic labor protections like 8-hour day, minimum wages, you know, health and safety standards at the work site, the right of collective bargaining and union recognition.
Is there any campaign or possibility that you see in the foreseeable future that you folks are working on really to deal with the labor laws and the fact that people are considered independent contractors and are really not subject to any of these fundamental possibilities that they need to in terms of benefits and so on?
Well, you know, in the New York City taxi context, much of this could be addressed by a more equitable, fair, you know, truly, you know, objective and just Taxi and Limousine Commission, which is the city regulator. I mean, in many ways, it could function similarly to how the Department of Labor functions, where, you know, they take grievances from workers, investigate them, and, you know, make fair rulings. Because, you see, we're hyper-regulated. It's not that the law doesn't look at us. It's that the law doesn't recognize our grievances. They don't recognize our right to file grievances. They don't recognize our right to have, you know, fair labor standards and conditions. But there is a regulatory agency that is heavily involved in this industry. And, you know, for the past 40 years, their bent has always been to really, you know, overly hyper-regulate the workers while they have deregulated the bosses. And that's something that we, in our 15-year struggle, we've been very aware of that, you know, and it's something that we've really targeted. And so last year, for the first time, we were able to get the city to form a lease caps enforcement unit at the TLC. And about 2 years ago, we were able to get the, you know, TLC to pass really some landmark regulations, including an anti-retaliation rule. So if a taxi driver files a complaint against a taxi boss with regards to an overcharge, the garage or the broker, you know, the corporation cannot retaliate against the driver, either by punishing them or taking away a benefit, like a decent car that the driver may have. And, you know, slowly but steadily, we've been making some, you know, some progress in that arena.
Really is a watershed moment. Your affiliation with the AFL-CIO, the significance of that, and, of course, what's coming up for you folks with the presence of Richard Trumka?
Yeah, it's just huge for us. April 26th, we hope all of our friends and drivers will come out and join us. We're having a celebration to mark the inauguration of the National Taxi Workers Alliance, where, you know, we're looking to build a strong, unified workers' voice in this industry. The bosses have their own trade association. The regulators have their own association. First order of business for them at each of their annual gatherings is to meet with each other. Well, now for the first time, the workers will be at the table. And we're sick and tired of being guinea pigs and, you know, the experiments of exploitation where city to city, the bosses and the regulators share their worst practices against us. We're standing up for ourselves to fight and build a just industry across all the borders throughout the U.S.
And this will be the first time that the AFL-CIO has allowed an affiliate that includes independent contractors and not just what is by law called workers.
That's right. And, you know, the farm workers were the most, you know, 60 years ago they had gotten a similar charter. We're the first one since then. And, you know, we couldn't be prouder of the fact that we're part of really, I think, a new resurgence in labor where, along with other workers like domestic workers and restaurant workers and day laborers and farm workers who continue to lead this heroic fight to really build a new labor movement that recognizes it's not up to the NLRB to decide who we are. We decide for ourselves, you know, when we're workers, and the workers decide whether or not we're a union.
And where can we go to hear Richard Trumka and to celebrate this historic moment and, of course, to continue to do work from the community perspective in supporting our sisters and brothers who are fighting entities like SLS, Jet Garage, and Long Island City?
Mm-hmm. So on Thursday, April 26th at 6 p.m., 52 Broadway, the United Federation of Teachers headquarters, we will have President Richard Trumka, the AFL-CIO, and Vinny Alvarez, who's the president of the New York City Central Labor Council, really dynamic, you know, labor leader, will be hosting the event with us. And we ask all our friends and allies, please come and support this. It will be the seed money to build the National Taxi Workers Alliance. You can get more information on our website at www.nytwa.org.
Beta V. Desai, Executive Director of the New York Taxi Workers Alliance, and we know soon the national head We really thank you for the years of work that you have put into this industry and the advances that are being made, but advances that we need to continue to keep a close eye on and support our brothers and sisters in the taxi industry. And now we turn our attention to representatives from the Muslim community with civil liberties advocates who came to Police Plaza to decry the NYPD Intelligence Division's blanket surveillance of a community based on religion and race, and to condemn new revelations about surveillance of community-based advocacy groups.
Recent documents unearthed reveal that the NYPD surveilled dozens of community organizations over the last decade. One document reveals that an undercover NYPD officer travels to New Orleans to attend the People's Summit, a gathering of groups organized around their shared opposition to U.S. economic and trade policies.
The undercover effort entailed groups opposed to U.S. immigration policy, labor laws, and racial profiling. The new revelations heighten and broaden the serious questions that have yet to be answered by the NYPD and elected officials.
Such as those surrounding its Muslim surveillance program and Police Commissioner Kelly's overstepping his authority with surveillance tactics that critics claim violate the U.S. Constitution. Now let's listen to the rally's speakers.
COINTELPRO, we say no!
Police surveillance has got to go.
Hey, hey,
ho, ho.
COINTELPRO, we say no.
Police surveillance has got to go.
My name is Monami Molik. I'm the executive director of DRUM. They see Rising Up and Moving. One of the organizations that have been cited on the most recent released documents of NYPD surveillance in Friday's AP articles. Our organization represents Muslim and South Asian New Yorkers. Our first speaker will be Fahad Ahmed, the legal and policy director at DRUM.
As the NYPD's leaked documents have indicated over the past several months, the NYPD has been surveilling Muslim communities in New York City and across the Northeast extensively. But the new set of documents indicate that their surveillance was not just limited to the Muslim community, but also extended to community groups, political organizations, and most notably those organizations engaged in criticizing the NYPD and demanding NYPD accountability. For months, whenever Commissioner Kelly has been questioned about these concerns, he says they're just following leads. If we are to take the NYPD commissioner on his word, the only logical conclusion we can come to is that the whole New York City Muslim communities and across the Northeast are under suspicion and pursuant to leads, and that all these organizations that are gathered here today and the other ones listed on these documents, and doubtlessly the ones that will come to be listed in the additional documents we will soon be seeing, are also under suspicion and being followed pursuant to leads. So for example, when Sean Bell's family has their son murdered by the NYPD and the family demands an investigation, that is a lead for the NYPD. When police accountability group organized a protest in support of Sean Bell and his family, that is a lead for the NYPD. When Muslim students organize a whitewater rafting trip to upstate New York, that is considered a lead by the NYPD. All this to say that the NYPD is engaged in whole-scale surveillance of communities just based on race, religion, ethnicity, and political beliefs and activities, all of which are clearly illegal. When all of this is going on, we return back to the fundamental question: who watches the NYPD? Who is there to hold the NYPD accountable, to make sure that there's transparency and make sure that there's oversight? We demand the City Council and other people with the authority institute some mechanisms of oversight and accountability over the NYPD. Until then, our communities will continue to raise our voices and continue to mobilize and demand for police accountability.
Police surveillance has got to go.
Hey, hey,
ho, ho. Police surveillance has got to go.
Our next speaker is going to be Councilmember Idanis Rodriguez.
It is our responsibility to protect our freedom of speech, our civil liberty. The year of J. Edgar Hoover should be over. We should not repeat the 1960s. We should not go back to the 1970s when the FBI was following everyone who looked at someone that, for their definition, were communists, because they were involved in a student group, because they were involved in the anti-war movement. The way how the city has been dealing with this issue is not fair. And I know, as Dominican, in the 80s, Dominicans were treated in a way with a lot of bias. I know what a stereotype means when it comes to Dominicans. In the 80s, most people talk about Dominicans as drug dealers. So what we are saying here today is enough is enough. This city belongs to all of us. This city belongs to the 50% that were born in another country. So everyone who has a great-grandfather who was an undocumented, who was an immigrant, the Muslim community, the white community, the Asian, the black, the Latino community, we should share the benefit of living in a city where the civil liberty has been protected for so many decades. So we are here to say we stand with the Muslim community again, having Commissioner Kelly in the NYPD put in surveillance. Kelly, you know, you are not the head of the FBI. You are in charge of a city agency where we at the city council is the one that hired for that position. And you are accountable to New Yorkers. And we as New Yorkers, with the Muslim brothers and sisters, our white, our black, our Asian, we are saying we are here to protect our liberty, and we will not take from no one to go after any particular group and their freedom, because the Muslim student, the Muslim senior citizen, as a black, the white, and other, we've been contributing so much to make New York City what we have.
Our next speaker is Helena Wong, Executive Director of CAV, Organizing Asian Communities, and a member of People's Justice for Community Control and Police Accountability.
People's Justice is a multiracial coalition in New York City formed in the wake of the killing of Sean Bell to support Sean Bell's family, to demand that the officers involved be held accountable, and to highlight the connections between the Bell case and broader police violence, to help communities develop strategies to combat and deter abusive policing. It's clear that People's Justice was targeted for organizing against police violence and for exercising our constitutional right to call for change, not for doing anything illegal. NYPD surveillance of anti-police violence organizations and other political organizations amounts to intimidation and builds a culture of fear in which it becomes difficult to stand up and exercise our First Amendment rights to free speech. It's just downright disrespectful that the NYPD would gather intelligence on the Bell family after killing their son. It's also had the effect of deterring other families from demanding justice for loved ones who are unjustly injured or killed by the police. Our organizations are being watched by the NYPD. But who is watching the police? Where is the accountability of unjust murders and beatings like that of Jatiq Reed or Marley Graham? Would a police department with proper oversight and proper principles be engaged in tactics that profile and criminalize entire communities? NYPD surveillance is not the only problem. It is part of a broad pattern of NYPD practices that are unjust, ineffective, and undermine community safety. The daily targeting of low-income people of color, LGBTQ folks, the homeless, youth, and immigrants for discriminatory tactics like stopping frisks are examples of the fact that NYPD is out of control. Recent killings and beatings are yet another example. We need a fundamental transformation in the way policing happens in New York. We need an end to NYPD spying and intimidation. We call for a federal investigation of the NYPD surveillance of community-based organizations and political groups. We need an end to NYPD targeting and profiling of entire communities. Independent oversight, increased transparency, and accountability of NYPD. And communities that are represented by the organizations at this press conference, Muslim, POC, low-income, youth, LGBT, homeless immigrants, we must come together along with policymakers and legal advocates to demand change, and that is what we are doing today.
Thank you. Our next speaker will be Imam Al-Haj Talib from the Mosque of Islamic Brotherhood.
I'm the president of the Islamic Leadership Council of New York, as well as the Imam of the Mosque of Islamic Brotherhood. Here we are again in another passing week of denials and avoidance on the part of the mayor and the police commissioner, and another week of truth and vindication on the part of those of us who have been challenging these unjust policies of warrantless surveillance. Months ago, when the Associated Press first broke this story, those of us who began to raise our voices about the issues in those stories, the mayor and the police commissioner both dismissed us. They've been smug, they've been arrogant. Ethnic mapping by the demographics unit of the NYPD. When you look at these secret NYPD documents, we see that in spite of the denials of the police commissioner, he said this surveillance is not about race, it's not about ethnicity, it's not about religion. However, the documents that are now being released on a weekly basis prove that that's not true. African Americans are the only non-immigrant ethnic group of Muslims who are on the list for surveillance on the NYPD list. In the papers that were just released, it says right at the top of the report, the NYPD is expressing its concern about what it referred to as our convert mosque. And then they list three mosques where the leadership and the origin of those mosques, and to this day, primary a population of worshipers are African American. They list the Mosque of Islamic Brotherhood, of which I am the Imam, Masjid al-Taqwa in Brooklyn, and Masjid al-Kamatuddin in Brooklyn. And so now those of us who are in these mosques, we're not only black, but we're black twice. Each passing week also reveals that the NYPD is no longer treating mosques with the same degree of sacredness as they treat other houses of worship. Throughout the years, houses of worship in New York City have always been considered what the police department refers to as sensitive locations that were entitled to a certain special protocol. So once again, we see that now in the post 9/11 world, that principle has gone out of the window, and it's certainly gone out of the window under the leadership of Ray Kelly. Is that the time has come for Speaker Christine Quinn to call for hearings on this. There are members of the city council, as you've already heard, our elected representatives who are trying to bring this to the floor. It's gone on long enough. I was watching Jesse Jackson speaking the other day about the murder of Trayvon Martin, and he said that the time has come to revisit the Kerner Commission and all of these commissions that were set up in order to investigate the impact of race and ethnicity on American government policy and law enforcement policy. And I think that's a very good idea. We need to do that here in New York. And Christine Quinn needs to stop avoiding the issue, because those of us in the Muslim community and others, whoever's going to run for mayor next, we intend to make sure that the events of these past several months is part of the litmus test of their fitness for office.
COINTELPRO, we say no, police fight has got to go. COINTELPRO, we say no, police fight has got to go.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash, and log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.